the calendar reflects that there was a case called, what was the name of the second?
Stewart.
Stewart, that was on as the second case for today, but that was stricken from the calendar. So the next matter we have scheduled is Lindmark Endowment for Corporate Business. Is every, are council and parties here on that case?
We are.
Everybody?
Correct.
All aboard who are coming aboard?
That's correct.
All right, then we can just keep going. As soon as, we'll let the marshal clean up the area, but council can come forward and take a seat.
Helen.
And Kay Norton is here.
Yeah, good.
Madeline, you'll reset the time?
Yes.
Yours isn't blinking. Is yours not?
Do you mean your numbers were blinking?
The numbers are blinking. I wonder if it's affected short.
But it looks like it was otherwise.
The time is seeming like it was working, but it was blinking on and off and being readily distractible. Tracy did stuff. All right, the next matter on the calendar is Lindmark Endowment for Corporate Business Ethics. As council are getting situated, I'll welcome you to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. My name is John Rodenberg. With me today are Judges Larkin and Smith. Each of council will have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if the appellant wishes to use that time. When you do approach the podium, give us your name and the party or parties you represent so that we've got that for the recording. The podium is adjustable, and there's a little toggle switch somewhere on there if you want to move it up or down for your convenience and comfort. Whenever appellant is ready, you may proceed. By the way, thank you for showing up early. We always ask people to do that, and not everybody does. So this is kind of why we do that, and I thank both of council for following that request.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court and counsel, corporate counsel for St. John's, Mr. Michael Cunningham, and his associate, Mr. James Thompson. I'm Attorney Roger Lindmark from Los Angeles, California. My local co-counsel, sitting to my right, is Mr. Bo McGraw. I represent the appellant. This case presents a typical bar exam civil procedure question. And here is the fact pattern hypothetical. But it's not hypothetical. This is what happened. Herman Schwafnagel owns a farm in Stearns County that is German on the father's side. And Ole Lundquist owns an adjoining farm, but that's Norwegian on the mother's side. But there's a strip of land of 5 acres between the two farms that they dispute. Herman wants the strip of land of 5 acres to cut down the trees and sell the logs to buy a new John Deere tractor. But Ole wants to keep the land to use it for deer hunting. They agreed on a mediation in June, at the end of June 2018, to resolve their dispute. And unbeknownst to Ole, Herman ran to the Stearns County Courthouse and filed a petition to resolve the dispute, of course, in Herman's favor. But Herman wrote up his petition citing all kinds of statutes and case law based on the maritime law of shipping rights in Lake Superior and the Port of Duluth. And he signed his petition with a notary's jurat under penalty of perjury. And within that petition, he did not tell the court, the district court, the entire truth of the dispute. That is what has occurred here in the case of the Lindmark Endowment. The endowment is not a trust. The endowment says it's not a trust on the fifth page of the document.
Counsel, is anyone contending that the endowment is a trust?
Yes.
Who?
St. John's. In their petition, they consistently referred to it as a charitable trust, and they cited throughout that petition and in subsequent pleadings the trust statutes and case law of Minnesota of 501B, 501C, and Section 309, which are all the trust statutes of Minnesota.
Isn't St. John's taking the position that the endowment is an institutional fund under MIFA?
Yes, but...
Isn't that different than a trust?
No, because the MIFA statutes, and I'll get into MIFA, the MIFA statutes are part and parcel of the 501B and 501C trust statutes. But there's two exceptions to the institutional fund of MIFA statutes, which are discussed in the opening brief, which I'll get into if you'd like. But to continue with the story, the petition that was filed on May 24th, 2018, never told the court that the document itself, the endowment document of five pages, says on its face, this is not a trust.
Did the district court here find that this is a trust?
The district court relied on the case of Longcore versus City of Red Wing and jumped to the conclusion, which was total error, that it was a charitable gift with conditions.
Okay, because I just want to be clear, because your time is limited, and I see that this case does raise important issues of first impression. You're complaining that St. John's is alleging that this is a trust, but the district court didn't make a finding that this is a trust. The district court treated it as an institutional fund under MIFA, and that's the decision we're reviewing. So regardless of what St. John's said in district court, what we have before us is the decision the district court made, which is this is an institutional fund under MIFA, and because it's an institutional fund under MIFA, you do not have standing to challenge St. John's request that the district court modify the terms of the endowment. So I wonder if we could just kind of focus on that argument, the two questions being, is this an institutional fund under MIFA, and if it is, do you have standing to challenge St. John's request to modify the terms of the endowment?
It is not an institutional fund because the program of the endowment comes under the two exceptions within the MIFA statute. That's discussed in the opening brief. The two exceptions are that it's a program-related asset, okay? And in the endowment document itself, on page 3, it's entitled Purpose. It says the annual endowment proceeds, blah, 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 is to be used to fund programs and activities in the field of corporate business ethics in the following order of priority, and there's five priorities. So it's a program-related asset. It is not an institutional fund or asset for investment purposes by St. John's, but the fund, which now is around $400,000, is put into the general pot of St. John's money and then invested in Wall Street, and they pull the interest off of it to pay the summer student stipends of $7,000. But the two exceptions are that it's a program-related asset, and secondly, that it applies to beneficiaries, and the beneficiaries are the student fellows who earn this $7,000 summer stipend. And it gets technical, but I've got it laid out in the brief. I don't want to spend a lot of time on it.
If you're not looking to spend a lot of time on that, could you address the district court's conclusion that if this is a fund under MIFA, you do not have standing to challenge St. John's request for modification because that standing is conferred generally on the Attorney General with some limited exceptions?
Okay. Under MIFA, the Attorney General would have standing if it was a trust. Under MIFA, it outlines the Attorney General's duties, but then it refers back to Section 501B and 501C. They're all linked together.
Okay.
But
what I'm wondering is this. We have case law, the Longcor case from the Minnesota Supreme Court, which essentially said, you know, at that time we didn't have charitable trust, but the Supreme Court said, by the time the opinion was written, we now have charitable trust, but we also have something called a charitable gift. You know, you're not limited to the creation of a trust in attempting to bequest upon a charitable institution a gift of funds for their charitable purposes. And what the Supreme Court said in that case is that when it comes to enforcement of any conditional terms of such a gift, enforcement ability should be the same for both charitable trusts and charitable gifts. And for charitable trusts, the Attorney General has enforcement authority first and foremost, and the same should apply for charitable gifts. So what I'm wondering is, isn't an institutional fund, as described in UPMIFA, simply a charitable gift? And if so, why don't the rules that apply to what we used to call a charitable gift also apply to a fund under UPMIFA? And those rules say it's governed by the law of trust. So even though this isn't a trust, the laws governing enforcement of trust may still apply.
Well, then there are no gifts. Every gift would then become a trust under the trust laws. And
well, not really. Longcor is pretty specific, and it said what the court was discussing was enforcement rights. It didn't say that, well, every aspect of trust law will apply to a charitable gift. It simply said, you know, the issue before it is who has standing to enforce the terms of a charitable gift, and the Supreme Court said we're going to treat this like a charitable trust for that purpose.
In Longcor, the Minnesota Supreme Court in 1940 held that the invalid trust, that's what they called it, that was set up in 1900 by Mr. Sheldon, of the residue of his will, that was an invalid trust. He set up trustees and the language, et cetera. They said, well, that's an invalid trust, but we want to give effect to Mr. Sheldon's intentions as the testator. So we will reach back into the common law and use the term charitable trust to effectuate his intentions. But after 1927, the common law terminology of charitable trust went out the window because it was codified as trust law in 1927. The Longcor case, I contend, is not dispositive of anything because it arose out of a will, not a negotiated contract of terms as the Lindmark Endowment is, which I contend is a contract.
Understood.
With terms memorialized in writing, signed by the party to be charged, offer, acceptance, a promise was made for a promise, there was benefit and detriment, and all the elements of contract are within the endowment. Those are not present in the Longcor case with Mr. Sheldon's will. Now, the Longcor said that only the Attorney General has standing, and that's what the district court relied on. That is because Mr. Longcor, who was suing, was one of 50,000 citizens of the city of Red Wing. And if he can sue because he doesn't like the way the city is managing the money, then every citizen can sue ad nauseam. There'd be vexatious litigation because one citizen would want a swimming pool, the next one would want a library, et cetera.
And you're correct. You are situated now, very differently from that plaintiff.
So
what I need to ask you, again, because your time is limited, and we have your briefing. It's very thorough, very extensive, so I want to make sure we make the most of this time. A plaintiff who is the donor is different than some hypothetical recipient of the benefits of the donation. But Minnesota law seems to be that not even the donor can necessarily sue to enforce the terms of a charitable gift or a charitable trust. It's still generally entrusted to the Attorney General to enforce the donor's intent. Now, there are exceptions set forth in the trust law where there is some sort of reversionary interest in the financial aspects of the gift or even some sort of property interest, which was recognized in Hill. Do you contend, assuming that a court were to conclude that the law of charitable trust does apply, do you contend that you fall within one of those recognized exceptions?
I fall under the exception of the Lewis Hill case of 1994, which is cited in the brief. When the Attorney General doesn't show up or doesn't want to assert standing and jurisdiction and oversight and intervene into the case, then the court can appoint a most interested person to have the standing. The Lewis Hill case was a trust case, okay? And in the record is a letter to the district court from the Attorney General dated October 5th, 3 days before the oral hearing, where the Attorney General said, "We take no position on St. John's motion and petition." St. John's was serving all of its pleadings on the Attorney General. I did not. Mr. Lindmark did not serve his pleadings because he considers it a contract. But even though the Attorney General had notice of the case, knew the facts and part of the arguments from St. John's pleadings, it didn't come into the case. It didn't intervene. If it wanted standing, it could have come in, filed a pleading, come to the oral argument. It did nothing. It sent, because it's not a trust, and under trust law, only the Attorney General would have the standing if the trust was registered properly with the Attorney General's office with an annual $25 fee and followed the proper trust requirements and formulas and format of setting up a trust and then registering it with the Attorney General. But even then, the Attorney General said, could say, well, I'm not interested.
And then in the, oh, excuse me.
Go ahead.
I'm not interested.
In the event the Attorney General is not interested, you seem to be claiming that the court was required then to appoint Mr. Lindmark as the interested person.
Of course.
Why? Why couldn't the court, what requires that, that the court do that? What do you point to as a requirement the court do that, if I may, presiding judge, exceed our time here?
Well,
and why need it be you?
Because.
Or your client.
There would be no other interested person. Not the students at St. John's, they've already graduated, okay? The only interested person would be the person who set up the endowment. And the Attorney General sent this letter to this district court saying, we're not going to get involved, we don't care what you guys do. And that was 3 days before the hearing, and the district court just disregarded that and said, well, I'm going to follow Longcore, that the Attorney General has absolute standing in all of these matters. The district court found that it was a gift, that's the term, a gift with conditions. But if it's a gift, on page 11 of the district court's decision, it defines gift as a transfer without consideration. And if it's a transfer, which is like dropping the $5 in the church basket, there's no consideration or detriment to the church receiving the $5, and therefore it can't be a contract and it can't be enforced by the giver, and the giver would have no standing to sue the church because they didn't use the $5 for what he wanted. But in this case, the Attorney General has stated, we're not coming into this case. And so the district court should have followed the Lewis Hill case and granted standing to Mr. Lindmark, who's the only interested party. The faculty at St. John's aren't interested. The administration is opposed to Mr. Lindmark. So who's going to have the standing as the most interested person to defend the endowment?
Mr. Lindmark, the time is up, and so I'm going to interrupt you. I want to leave you with this thought, though. When you use your rebuttal time, if you choose to do so, I would like to have you tell me, if we were to publish in this case of first impression, what should be the court's syllabus point? In other words, to boil that all down to a principle of law that we should say governs this case. Not now. On rebuttal, because your 15 minutes is up.
Well, I would ask for an extension of that time.
I already extended it for a period of time.
Because my speech was cut off with too many questions.
I already extended the time several minutes, so you'll have 5 minutes on rebuttal if you wish to use that time. Respondent.
May it please the court. My name is Michael Cunningham. I'm appearing here on behalf of St. John's University, the respondent, and with me is James Thompson, also appearing on behalf of St. John's. May it please the court and counsel. Mr. Lindmark does not have standing to oppose the petition of St. John's that was filed in the district court regarding the administration of the endowment that is being administered by St. John's. Why not? The reasons were addressed and dealt with great particularity and specificity in the district court's order. The district court found that the endowment in question was the result or constituted a charitable gift or was the result of charitable gifts. Picking up on the court's question of Mr. Lindmark, this endowment is an endowment. It's the result of charitable gifts. It's also an institutional fund. Things can be, if you will, more than just one thing. In this case, the endowment was the product of and consists of a charitable gift, and as a consequence, it was and it is governed by a gift instrument, not a contract, but it is governed by a gift instrument which only the Attorney General has the authority to enforce under Minnesota law, as well as all of the additional authorities, if you will, which have spoken to this topic. The district court went on and made a second determination in this case.
Is the gift instrument to which you're referring the 2010 document?
It is, Your Honor.
Thank you.
It's called a gift instrument.
Thank you.
Counsel, could I interrupt with a question? That is the heart of what we do here, an opportunity to engage in a discussion with the attorneys about the issue.
Absolutely.
So that we can make an informed decision. I'm hearing something about conditional charitable gift, institutional fund under MIFA, and charitable trust. So do we have three things that could be at play here? And is the notion of a charitable gift or a charitable conditional gift a notion that's at common law? And then is there a situation where every charitable gift is also an institutional fund under UPMIFA, setting aside exceptions?
The answer to your question, I thought, was do we have a charitable gift with conditions, an institutional fund, and then you had a third component.
Charitable trust.
And the answer is it can be all three of those things. And frankly, it is our position that it is in this case. And I don't want to get too far off the track on this word trust that appears in the document. We've addressed that in the briefs. It is our position that that is in fact referring to what is called an express trust, if you will, a common civil type trust, not a charitable trust. The document considered in its entirety clearly reflects that we're talking about a gift.
Well, doesn't the document actually say this is a gift governed by UPMIFA?
You got it right.
And how much clearer can we get on intent?
Honor, that it says that. It says it's a gift governed by UPMIFA. And turning to that point, the district court found that it was an institutional fund, and the district court under UPMIFA, and therefore UPMIFA applied. That's what the district court found. The district court was correct in making that finding. Mr. Lindmark argues that that was an erroneous finding. It was not an erroneous finding, but even if this is not an institutional fund under UPMIFA, he still doesn't have standing. He cannot cite to anything that says that we'll go with his program.
Unless it's a contract. His argument is this is a contract.
Excuse
then he would have standing to enforce his contract rights.
That, He does make that argument, which is separate and distinct from his MIFA doesn't apply argument. And I was intending my comment only to apply to the first part of his argument.
But to be fair, he has provided a theory of standing, and that theory would be this was the creation of a contractual relationship. He is the beneficiary of the contractual terms, and he's seeking to enforce those terms.
Yeah, and on that point, and again, it's been addressed, and it was addressed by the district court. I might just kind of comment here on the quality of this district court's opinion before I get into any more detail. I appreciate that she granted a summary judgment motion. I appreciate that this is before this court on a de novo review standard. But the quality of the opinion of the district court is outstanding.
Can you?
A very high-level decision. It's comprehensive. It reflects a lot of legwork on the part of the district court by herself, if you will, or clerk, or whoever did it.
Okay.
It,
counsel,
yes.
Could I interrupt? In terms of the grant of summary judgment, I just want to make sure I'm understanding it. Although the district court granted summary judgment, she didn't necessarily grant summary judgment on your requested relief. Rather, the summary judgment award was limited to the issue, or actually was probably best viewed as limited to Mr. Lindmark's opposition. In other words, summary judgment as to the question whether or not Mr. Lindmark had standing to oppose your request for relief. But the district court had not actually ruled on your request for relief.
And again, Your Honor, you're absolutely correct.
Okay.
And the motion, the dispositive motion that St. John's filed in this case was to dismiss Mr. Lindmark's opposition. And the district court, in her order, said, I'm considering things outside the, if you will, the pleadings,
yeah.
And therefore I'm going to treat this as a summary judgment motion, which she did. Then she makes an accurate statement of the facts in the case and concludes, as I've already said, that this is a charitable, that what we're talking about here are charitable gifts, an institutional fund, and this gentleman has no standing either under a MIFA or under common law. Go ahead.
What do you say to Mr. Lindmark's argument that if, in fact, this is under MIFA, and if, in fact, the Attorney General is entrusted with the power to enforce the donor's intent, Mr. Lindmark's intent in setting up the endowment, he nonetheless should be allowed to oppose St. John's petition because the Attorney General is not participating to enforce his intent as the donor?
I say at least two things. One is that Mr. Lindmark's not the donor, okay? And there can be no serious dispute with respect to the fact that he's not the donor. He has no special interest in respect to the institutional fund disendowment. He is not the donor. It's set forth clearly in the record in this case. The $50,000 that initiated the establishment of this endowment in 2004 was a gift from American Express. The gift instrument says that, but the underlying documentation further corroborates that. It was the product of a court order in a class action case in California directing that this $50,000 be paid to St. John's. That court order, which is in the record, reflects that an additional payments were to be made to other not-for-profit institutions. This money, he never owned the funds that came into this endowment. Subsequently, in 2008, another $250,000 contribution gift was made to this endowment. It did not come from Mr. Lindmark. He never owned those funds. It came from class action counsel in an antitrust case in California. The documents are in the record, and it clearly reflects the identity of who's to make that payment. Class counsel for the plaintiffs. That was not Mr. Lindmark. The payment came from a law firm in California, from a trust account at that law firm, not Mr. Lindmark. So he's not the donor. But coming to the second part, so now we have
the question. That seems to be a disputed issue of fact. And my question is
pardon?
That seems to be a disputed issue of fact because he has an argument as to why he is the donor and those would have been his
fees. I've never heard his argument.
I think his brief pretty clearly makes it. What about the participation of the Attorney General
sure.
in this case?
Okay. First of all, here, the Attorney General is, the word participating needs some definition. The Attorney General is monitoring this case. The Attorney General-
What is this letter? I mean, he says the Attorney General sent a letter saying, I think his words, I don't care what you guys are doing, just do what you're going to do.
That's not what the letter says, okay? There's a lot of looseness here as to what these documents say. That, you can read it, I won't try to. It in fact indicates that the Attorney General is weighing in on the principles of law that are involved in this case.
How so?
With respect to the application of a MIFA in this case, which, if it is an institutional fund, then turns you to 501B, Chapter 501B, the Charitable Organizations Act. And the Attorney General indicates and confirms two or three things, that this petition and the process has been correct, that they're informed, that they certainly have all of St. John's pleadings. It's an interesting concept that I might note here that Mr. Lindmark has never asked the Attorney General to intervene. He's never complained to the Attorney General regarding the administration of this endowment by St. John's. He has had communications with the Attorney General, and he has asked them for information. He doesn't want the Attorney General involved in this case. The best interpretation of what has transpired, and we've enclosed, as part of the record, are these communications with the state of Minnesota. If he wanted the Attorney General in this case and is upset that they're not, he could have tried to get him in. But that aside, they're not officially in the case. And that is their prerogative. But there are a lot of charitable gifts.
Well, let me ask you this. If they're not officially in the case, do we have a concern? If we were to assume everything the district court said is correct, at the end of the day, there still seems to be a recognition in case law in a couple of different cases that, you know, generally speaking, the Attorney General is entrusted to enforce the donor's intent, setting aside dispute who the donor is. Different circumstances result if the Attorney General is not stepping up to enforce the donor's intent. Is that a concern here, that there is no one currently in court opposing St. John's petition in a way that seeks to enforce the donor's intent?
No, is the short answer to your question. And the reasons why are because, and now I'm going to get redundant, I've got my yellow light. The reasons are because the Attorney General, number one, has made an informed decision here. And just to make sure we don't lose sight of the context, there are a lot of charitable trust proceedings and petitions, and the Attorney General gets notice of these, and they have to make some decisions about how to use their resources. Here, they've made a real informed decision, and if you look at the letter, you'll see that. In addition to that, the court, St. John's initiated this proceeding. Mr. Lindmark didn't initiate it. In fact, he wrote a letter to St. John's saying he demanded that all the faculty involved be fired and that the money be returned to him, even though it didn't come from him, and a whole variety of outrageous demands. That aside, here, the court also is involved, and the court also has a function of safeguarding, if you will, the interests of the public, okay? And the court has a duty and will have a duty when the merits of this petition come before the district court to evaluate the merits of the petition and decide whether or not the changes, if you will, to the criteria governing the gift should or should not be permitted. And you're a judge. You know, we might be back here before you on another de novo review, although I'm not sure that one would be de novo. I kind of think not. But we have that involved here as well. No one's trying to end run the district court. No one is trying to bypass either the statutory authorities or the other authorities. The principle is that as a matter of both statute, in the case of MIFA, common law under Longcore, that it is the Attorney General that is supposed to do this.
So,
why?
Yes. So I just want to, so your rule of thumb, your rule is that the Attorney General has, I think, exclusive enforcement authority, and you say based on MIFA and common law. What, can you just point me to, just briefly, what is your MIFA basis for that? When you look at MIFA, you say based on the statute. Where do I look in a statute
Look at MIFA, and then it takes you to the Charitable Organizations Act, Chapter 501B.
Okay, so we look at MIFA is silent about standing, but it does say that a modification may be made if you pursuant to 501B.31 subdivision 2 or 4.
And 501B then tells you you're supposed to notify the Attorney General, okay? And then 501C, they're all applicable here, which is the new trust code, but was in place at the time this was started, has a definition of what constitutes an interested party. Mr. Lindmark does not fall within the definition of an interested party under...
Well, I guess I wanted to be more specific about, because sometimes you're saying not all of 501B applies, because I think you didn't want the 0.41, right? Am I making a mistake there? Isn't it? Yeah, your brief says 501B.41 subdivision 4 does not apply, page 18 of your brief. So there's something that doesn't apply in 501B, and I'm just trying to track the actual statutory language to see, is there something in the statute where it cites particular subdivisions of the next statute,
the answer,
and then
I
cites...
Excuse me.
And then it goes on to 501B, the specific subdivision, points to 501C.0202, and then you go to 0.0203 in your brief. I'm trying to figure out why sometimes we expand beyond the cited subdivisions in a statute and sometimes we're not supposed to. That's what's confusing to me.
Maybe I'm not supposed to do this, Judge, but the interplay of these statutes is hard to follow, okay? And I'm not trying to say it isn't, okay? But nevertheless, if you follow it, it indicates that there is an exception to the Attorney General rule only, and that is if someone has retained a property right or a special interest in the endowment funds. Not true here. Not true in this case. And so there is an exception, by the way. And the Hill case is easily distinguishable, and he cited the Hill case, from this case, because in the Hill case, it was, by the way, a charitable trust case, number one. And number two, it dealt with the concept that the person who was seeking to have a seat at the table was going to be eliminated from his status as a member of a nominating committee. And the court in the Hill case determined that that constituted, I'm going to use the word, a sufficient interest to get you within the standing requirements, which Mr. Lindmark, notwithstanding all of his remarks, he as a matter of fact, he just simply can't do
counsel,
that.
Counsel, just if I may.
You may, although I'm going to end that as I did with appellant's counsel after the response to this question.
I just want to make sure, following up on Judge Smith's question, is it fair to say that there is nothing in MIFA that expressly says Attorney General has exclusive enforcement authority, and that the only way you can link what's going on in this case to those statutory trust provisions regarding enforcement authority and exceptions to the general rule that it's only the Attorney General would be maybe to say that this falls under MIFA, and then under that Landcor decision, draw the analogy that, well, this is like the charitable gift in Landcor. Supreme Court has said for such charitable gifts, we're going to treat them like charitable trusts when it comes to enforcement, which would provide some sort of legal link and some sort of authority in regarding who is to enforce a charitable gift under MIFA.
I think you're generally correct, okay. And I understand you're going to
tell me to
sit down. But if you read these comments, if you read footnotes 1, 2, and 3 to this district court's opinion, she has dug into what the commentators, whether it's the Uniform Commissioner of Law's commentators, the Minnesota Attorney General's charity guidebook, whatever, and she's really dug into why only the Attorney General has standing in a situation like this unless there is some compelling exception to that common law rule. Thank you.
Thank you. Appellant has 5 minutes for rebuttal if you wish to use that time. And it appears that you do.
Yes, Your Honor. To respond to something Mr. Cunningham said regarding the money did not come from Lindmark. It came from these class action settlements. But on the fifth page of the endowment document, and I'm holding it right here, Lindmark signs it on June 4th, 2010, and above that is the wording donor's signature. There is no case law anywhere that says that consideration for something must be paid out of the pocket of the giver or the offeror. If I buy a car, but my mother pays the money.
Consideration, a different question from a donor, though? I mean, I think the question is, who's the donor? Who and did it come out of his income?
No, what it was, it was a forbearance, and that brings it into contract law. He forbeared, he gave up part of his fee in the class action cases and negotiated that money be paid into his endowment. That's what happened. It was a forbearance, and forbearance is consideration. So it's a contract. If it walks like a duck and flies like a duck, it's a duck, okay? Regardless of the wording of, was the word donor used? Was the word offeror used? Giver? There's all kinds of words that could have been used, but the mechanics of the Lindmark Endowment are contract. Now, secondly, in the Attorney General's letter of October 5th, regarding its position, it's on the bottom of the second page of his letter. It says, although this office takes no position as to the relief requested in the petition or in the petitioner's motion, it takes no position. They don't care. So they're essentially saying, you guys do what you want. We're not getting involved. It could have intervened. It didn't. Also, regarding Judge Rosenberg's question, what is the rule of law that should be set down? It should be, if the AG refuses to participate, then the donor is appointed, because the donor is the only one who would be the interested person. And that is the Lewis Hill case, is that the Attorney General didn't show up at the court hearing, and the court said, well, Mr. Hill, which was a family relative, you take over and you can have the standing. And they cited a case from Hawaii and a Minnesota case that affirmed that argument and that position. I'd like to bring the court's attention. There's, in the second century in Rome, the author, poet, and satirist, Juvenal, he said the following, quis custodet ipsos custodes, which translates into, who shall guard the guards themselves? Or otherwise interpreted as, who should watch the watchers? Well, who's watching St. John's? Well, it needs watching. The Attorney General is not going to watch it. But if we turn to our red-covered responding brief on page 28, we will see why St. John's needs to be watched. They made a judicial admission on page 28, and it states where they're complaining about this litigation. And they say, thus, the only practical effects of voiding the district court's judgment would be duplicative work for the district court, comma, added delay in this already delayed proceeding, comma, and a further drain on the resources of the endowment to pay litigation expenses. Typically, wills and trusts have a clause in them that provide for litigation costs and expenses and fees if a trust or will is challenged by an heir, that the estate will pay the litigation costs. There is no such clause in the Lindmark Endowment. It appears from this judicial admission that St. John's is tapping in to the endowment fund to pay Mr. Cunningham's fees and costs, which is a conversion of the endowment funds and a waste of those funds because the endowment document does not provide for it. This is a contract. It walks like a duck.
Can I ask a question?
It flies like a duck.
Apropos of your statement which I appreciate that the syllabus point you provided, if the AG refuses to participate, then the donor must be appointed as an interested person. I assume we mean under a MIFA. I mean, we're outside of the contract world. You're saying even if it's if it's contract, we don't need to worry about the Attorney General. You have a contract case. But if it's, I'm assuming you're saying, if I may, Presiding
yes,
Judge,
you
that
may.
Under a MIFA, if the AG refuses to participate, the donor must be appointed as an interested person. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay.
Because nobody can order the Attorney General to do something it doesn't want to do.
So if the Attorney General, I just want to understand your position, if the Attorney General did decide to participate in this case, the donor, well, excuse me, Mr. Lindmark, would have no ability to participate. It all depends on whether the AG, so the donor's participation is completely contingent upon the AG's decision to participate or not?
No.
Or do you think the donor still has an opportunity
to
participate?
No. My position is that an AG has no standing whatsoever because the AG's powers come out of 501B and 501C, which is wrapped into the UPMIFA. And UPMIFA refers back to 501B and C, which authorizes the AG's powers to have standing. And therefore, because this Lindmark endowment has nothing to do with the trust statutes of Minnesota, it was never formulated as a trust, it was never registered with the Attorney General, it has nothing to do with the trust statutes, are totally irrelevant, and therefore the AG has no power of standing. If the AG tries to come in and say, we have the standing, we're going to take over this litigation, I would oppose that.
Okay.
We'd be here again on an appeal on that issue.
Okay.
Thank you.
And time is up. We thank counsel for your briefing and argument. Rules are rules, and we could probably talk about this case all morning. So we're gonna end it there. We will issue our decision within 90 days, and we thank counsel for your briefing and argument.
Thank you.